I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Susan G. Komen Foundation, the country's leading breast cancer advocacy group, has issued an apology and a reversal of its decision to cut most of its funding to Planned Parenthood. The announcement came in a statement in which the group said it would amend its new criteria, which now bars grants to organizations under investigation, to say that those investigations must be criminal and conclusive to disqualify groups. Washington Post healthcare reporter Lena Sun is with us. And Lena, this is all just happening. But do you get the sense that the Komen Foundation was reacting to the backlash it was getting?
Oh, yes. There's no question about it. They, I think, were overwhelmed and surprised by how this played out. And I think that they did not handle the way this decision was made publicly. They didn't handle it well at all. And part of the reason I think that there's been such a strong backlash is because it's still unclear, even with this latest statement, about what exactly will go to Planned Parenthood. They didn't say, yes, you know, we're going to fund Planned Parenthood. What they said was, okay, we've changed the criteria, so if you're under investigation, you will be disqualified, but only if it's criminal or conclusive in nature.
So we don't know what's going to go from there. Yeah. But the tone of the letter, you know, definitely is apologetic. We want to apologize to the American people for recent decisions that cast doubt on our commitment to our mission. And this all sparked up, we should remind people, because the Komen Foundation board member John Raffaele had said the charity was worried that an investigation of Planned Parenthood by a Republican congressman would damage Komen's credibility. But critics thought all along it was to damage Planned Parenthood, which does provide abortions. And those critics cited the hiring of the new vice president, the Georgia Republican Karen Handel, who ran for governor on a platform that emphasized defunding Planned Parenthood. So, you know, what did Komen say about some of those political charges?
Now, Komen has said that there was never a political issue, that not political pressure, and in fact, their latest statement today still leaves some doubt, some ambiguity, because just yesterday they had said the real reason this had happened is because they wanted to change the way they funded their grantees, funded providers, and they didn't want to send money to people who didn't provide direct breast cancer screening services. So this doesn't address that because, you know, Planned Parenthood still does not provide mammograms on site. They refer out to other clinics. So it's still unclear. And I think that they just have not done a really good job of getting their message out and explaining to people why they did what they did.
Yeah. And the sentence, by the way, regarding Planned Parenthood says that we will continue to fund existing grants, including those of Planned Parenthood, and preserve their eligibility to apply for future grants. So, as you say, that's a little bit hazy right now. But meanwhile, Sarah Wheat, who's interim CEO of Planned Parenthood in the Austin area, said her office was tearing up over the news. But anti-abortion groups are not happy. Where do you think this is? How do you think this is going to play out?
I don't know. I mean, I just think that they, you know, they've always been under pressure because they gave grants to Planned Parenthood. And sometime last year, they decided that they needed to sort of deal with this issue. And then this grant-making change was announced. And when they announced the grant-making change, was explained that Planned Parenthood would be the one that would be impacted. And I think they're now getting buffeted on both sides. They're sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Yeah. Well, and some, like I'm thinking of the Boston Globe, which wrote an editorial, you know, critical of Komen's move, but also saying, look, if you are going to take a stand, at least say, be willing to admit that you're taking a position, pro-life, pro-choice, either way, say it. As you said, the group is getting buffeted from all sides.
Right. And I think they want to make clear, their board members, everybody feels like they don't want to become political. They only want to deal with breast cancer screenings. And unfortunately, they feel like that every time, they feel like they've been pulled into that by both sides, you know, by what's happened.
Washington Post healthcare reporter Lena Sun on the news just today that the Susan G. Komen Foundation has apologized and seemed to have reversed its decision to cut funding to Planned Parenthood. We'll continue to follow this for you. Lena, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Fox comedy Glee is known for satirizing stereotypes. Recently, they looked at overachieving Asian American students through two of the show's stars, Mike and Tina.
I'm overwhelmed and losing focus. Football, Glee Club, Booty camps, we're ready for sectionals. I got an A-minus, Tina.
You got an Asian F?
Dad is all over me.
Asian F sounds like a joke, but according to research, Asian Americans must score 140 to 450 points higher than other ethnic groups to get admitted to private colleges. And Bloomberg News reports that the U.S. Department of Education is investigating charges that Harvard and Princeton discriminate against Asian Americans by holding them to a higher standard. Dan Golden is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who now covers higher education for Bloomberg News. Dan, first of all, tell us about these complaints, and they are just complaints, nothing further, against Harvard and Princeton.
Well, there was a student whose family originally came from India. He's a Californian student, and he was turned down by Princeton and Harvard for this year's freshman class. And he and his family, I guess, brought a complaint to the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, saying that he was turned down on the basis of race or national origin. And the Department of Education has, this month, it began to look into the complaint against Harvard. It agreed to investigate that. And the Princeton one, there was sort of a pre-existing Princeton complaint from 2006 from a similar student, a Chinese-American student who had a perfect SAT score and didn't get into Princeton. And that was then in 2008 expanded into a broader review of Princeton admissions. The current complaint is being folded into that broader review.
Well, we don't know too many more specifics, but the presumption is that this student felt that he had good enough scores to get into Harvard. So here we go, wading into the murky waters of admissions and the debates over quotas and diversity. From the Harvard side, the position we understand has always been that Harvard could fill its admissions with perfect scores and valedictorians, but then they'd have no diversity. So they take people with maybe lower scores, but maybe leadership skills. And wouldn't it follow that if Asians fall disproportionately in the category of, you know, really high scores, then they would suffer more? In other words, where does a school's need to have diversity fit into the debate that's now unfolding?
Well, you're right. It is a very complicated issue because universities always say we do a very individual look and we take a lot of things into account. On the other hand, they always do take test scores into account. The studies consistently show that Asian Americans need a higher test score, but that could be because whites benefit from other preferences that colleges don't like to talk about as much. Namely, whites are more likely to be children of alumni or children of big donors, and those groups get in with lower scores, and that may account for some of the difference. In addition, whites are more likely to be recruited athletes than Asian Americans are, and recruited athletes also get in with lower scores and grades. So that's an important distinction legally, because these colleges are not allowed to deny somebody admission because of their race, but they are allowed to discriminate on the basis of preferences such as alumni child status or recruited athlete.
Well, help us, though, more with this understanding of how schools can use race, because we understood the 2003 Supreme Court decision about the University of Michigan's admissions upheld their use of race to achieve what they called critical mass of minorities, blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans. So in that case, we thought race was allowed to be used to, again, achieve diversity.
Yes, you're right. They can use race as one of many factors in considering applicants in order to promote diversity. In other words, to increase the number of students who are from underrepresented minorities. That's under challenge again in a case that the Supreme Court is considering whether to hear.
Well, you quoted the disparity in scores and the research. Those stats come from the 2009 book No Longer Separate, Not Yet Equal. It did find that Asian Americans need to score 140 points more than whites, 270 points higher than Hispanics, 450 points higher than African Americans to have the same chance of admission to a private college. But again, that might be this attempt to achieve critical mass for unrepresented groups. And as a result, another group is being bumped out, because Harvard and Princeton would point out that Asian Americans are well represented in that they account for about 18% of the students at Princeton and 16% at Harvard, while making up only 5% of the general population.
Yeah, you raise a number of interesting points there. The numbers from that study of the 140-point gap between Asian Americans and whites, that's when all other credentials are held equal. For example, having the same high school grades and class rank. But, yeah, you do make an interesting point. Asian Americans are overrepresented at these schools based on population, but they're underrepresented based on their test scores. And it's in a way analogous to the situation that Jews faced in the first half of the 20th century when there were quotas on Jewish admissions where Jews, again, they were present in the Ivy League and other elite schools in greater numbers than you would have predicted based on their population, but not as many as you would have expected based on their academic credentials. And we see a somewhat similar situation today, although there's no documentation of quotas, but a lot of people have noticed that at most Ivy League schools, the Asian American population tends to hover between, 15 to 20% year after year. It never seems to crack that 20% barrier.
Well, and by the way, you mentioned the Jewish students in the early 20th century at Ivy League schools being held to a quota because schools felt they were overrepresented. And question, it's probably not relevant because it was so long ago, but was that legal then?
That was largely based on anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And in order to keep the Jewish population down without expressly saying it was an anti-Jewish policy, the colleges came up with some of the other preferences that still exist today, such as the preference for alumni children, which worked against Jews at the time because there weren't many Jewish alumni. Also, the geographic diversity preference, where they say, you know, we want to have students from all the states, including the small rural states. Since Jews were, concentrated in the New York area, geographic diversity worked against them, and to some degree probably hurts Asian Americans today because so many of the high-achieving Asian Americans are from California.
So, Dan Golden, one last question. This is now being investigated by the Department of Education. There are Asian students today who feel it is discrimination and not an attempt at diversity. And I suppose we may find out, but isn't this what you're calling for? More transparency in admissions.
Yeah, I think that it would be a good idea for colleges to be more transparent. For example, you know, as you mentioned, colleges consistently say, well, it's no surprise we turn down Asian American students, say, with perfect test scores because we turn down half of all students, say, with 2,400 SAT scores. But they never have given a breakdown of those students with perfect test scores that we turn down, how many are Asian American, how many are white, how many are black, how many are Hispanic. And, you know, one might theorize that if it turns out that the overwhelming majority of students with 2,400 SAT scores who are rejected are Asian American, then it wouldn't necessarily show that the colleges, just don't take test scores that seriously. What it would show is that they want to keep down the Asian American population. So until we can see those kind of numbers, and presumably that's what the Department of Education is looking for, it's hard to draw a firm conclusion as to, you know, what's behind this pattern.
Dan Golden of Bloomberg News. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jasmine Zhuang is the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants. She's a junior at Yale. She joins us by Skype from her dorm. Jasmine, you didn't check the Asian box, but your name is obviously Asian, and you wrote your college essay about being Asian, so this wasn't to improve your odds. What was your goal? Why didn't you check the box?
I don't think I was really fooling anyone. I knew that there weren't too many advantages to me not checking the box, but I had heard about this higher standard that Asians are expected to achieve, and I think I didn't check the box more so as a symbolic act rather than actually trying to achieve a higher possibility of admission.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about the feelings behind that.
I think I was definitely angry to some extent. I don't think college admission should be based on race at all, and I felt like they were projecting kind of stereotypes on me just because I was part of a group instead of really considering me as an individual.
Well, what do you think of the school's claims that they do that, that they actually take a holistic approach to admissions, and in fact, they want to look at more than just test scores and grades, and so their feeling is that they are taking a more holistic approach?
I think there's certain unconscious biases that they're probably in their minds when they're reading these applications.
Of course, we know all Asian American kids don't have, you know, the perfect scores. But there are definitely higher scores, and some are attributing that to the fact that many of these kids are the children of immigrants. Immigrants tend to push their kids more. And we, of course, know the tiger mother who wrote that book that was so controversial. She wrote, Chinese parents can order their kids to get straight A's. American parents can only ask them to do their best. But so in that context, Did you feel pressure as the child of Taiwanese immigrants to do better?
I think at a young age, they really pushed me to excel and really pushed me to value my education and my extracurriculars. But I think by the time I got to high school, they had a much more chill approach and they really trusted me to do my own work and to be able to excel on my own. And I'm not sure how much of that has to do with me being the child of immigrants. I think that definitely has something to do with it. Me wanting to make sure that I was more successful than the last generation because they had given up so much to come to this country.
Yeah. And just one last question before we let you go, Jasmine. As you've said, your not checking the Asian box was more of a symbolic gesture. We're also hearing of kids who feel very uncomfortable about not checking the box. One girl who was mixed race said, it would feel as if a school was only accepting half of me.
I feel like people who maybe check boxes of certain races or didn't check boxes at all, sometimes it makes them doubt the validity of why they got in. And that's something that might hang over their heads for several years. Just not knowing whether you got in or didn't get in because of whether you checked a race box or not.
Jasmine Zhuang, junior at Yale University, on Skype there from her room. Jasmine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And let's close out this subject with Ouyang Poon. Her parents are from Hong Kong. She grew up in Boston and is now doing postdoctoral work on racial inequalities in education at UCLA. Ouyang, you say that if these Ivy League schools are discriminating, they're doing a lousy job. Why?
What was the incoming class at Harvard? Something like 16-17% Asian American?
Yes, that's about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty high percentage to be discriminating. However, I do want to note that I wonder how many of that 16-17% of Harvard's incoming class are those Asian Americans coming from low-income backgrounds, refugee backgrounds.
California state schools instituted race-blind admissions in the 90s, and the number of Asians accepted jumped from 20% to 40% at UC Berkeley. So you say, look at the high percentage at Harvard, but what might it be double if they didn't consider race?
It's very difficult to know because we're not quite sure what Harvard is valuing in their schema, their plan and process of selection. However, I think a lot of times people think that these processes are kind of willy-nilly, but my experiences as an admissions reader has been that it's very strict in terms of common criteria and value of how students are examined and reviewed in a very holistic and fair way.
So, we should mention that you have been part of this process. You were a reader at UC Davis, meaning that you read the applications, and you are saying that you saw firsthand that it was sort of a holistic process. It didn't feel discriminatory. I'm wondering, is there something that perhaps Asian American families should be thinking of? I mean, perhaps a school can get one too many applications with perfect test scores and a child who is, you know, plays the violin perfectly. I know that's a stereotype, but that's sort of what this is about.
Right. What was very shocking to me as a reader was that Asian American students, particularly more middle class Asian Americans, had very similar profiles to each other, and it set me on my research path and agenda in terms of wanting to understand how does this very similar profile come about, and what I've concluded has been that it's very much informed by an immigrant experience and fears of discrimination in the United States. They want to push their children much harder because they recognize discrimination in society. And so my message to probably parents would be that they're thinking too hard in terms of like what exactly will get their child in, rather than trying to really support and challenge their children to pursue their natural talents and passions. And so I think that would probably diversify their portfolios a lot more. But I cannot blame the parents for pushing their children in a certain way because they've seen so-and-so's kid did this to get into this university. Mm-hmm. But they're, again, their views of what they need to do and the institutions that are available to them are very limited. And excellent colleges like Amherst College and Williams College, Bates College, Colby College, Bowdoin, Middlebury, you know, these are colleges that a lot of Asian American immigrant communities don't really know about, nor do they apply to, but they're just as excellent as the Ivy Leagues.
And by the way, we have to remember that a lot of the restrictions on Asian immigration to the U.S. only were loosened in the 60s. I mean, this is a recent wave in many cases of immigrants, and you're saying,
right,
you know, think outside the box of what you thought was the path to education and see your child, maybe you see your child more holistically.
That's true.
true.
Ouyan Poon, her parents are from Hong Kong. She grew up in Boston and is now doing postdoctoral work on racial inequalities in education at UCLA. So, Ouyan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Putin, go away. That's the message on a banner hanging across the Moscow River from the Kremlin. A growing number of Russians say two terms was enough for then-president, now Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. But Putin is running again in March, and many Russians are worried that the elections will be rigged, as they believe the parliamentary elections were in December. Putin's party, United Russia, won then, but that sparked huge protests, which will continue this weekend when thousands are expected to flood the streets of Moscow and other Russian cities. The BBC's James Kumarasamy is in Moscow. He joins us. And what is the feel on the streets there?
Cold, I guess, is in a word. It is very, very cold. And I'm perhaps being slightly flippant, but actually that could well have an effect on the number of people who turn out at the protests. They are predicting minus 25 overnight, and that could have an effect.
Right.
It's interesting. I've been travelling around Russia trying to get a sense of what people around the country, and it's very different here in Moscow to outside. Here in Moscow, there is a group of generally young, quite middle-class people who really do feel, as you said, the elections in December were stolen, and also do not like the fact that, as they see it, Vladimir Putin is being foisted on them, possibly for another 12 years if he's re-elected under the new terms of the Constitution. So I think the mood here is determined. There is a pretty committed band of tech-savvy, very, not angry, but people who feel that they have been taken for granted. They've done well out of Vladimir Putin. They've done well over the last decade or so. But now they want to be the same as the rest of Europe. They believe that Russia has changed and the leadership needs to change with it.
Well, what about outside Moscow?
Yeah, outside Moscow, interesting. I travelled to a city called Nizhny Novgorod. It's about 5 hours on an overnight train from here. About 20 years ago, just after the Soviet Union fell, it was a very, very liberal city. It opened up to the West. Well, now the authorities there have really clamped down on the protests. There's due to be a protest there, smaller than the one here in Moscow, but it is not being sanctioned. So it'll be interesting to see if they crack down there. Again, the group of people protesting are perhaps more diverse than they are here in Moscow and smaller in number. But nevertheless, there are people with similar feelings. Go further afield still. I went to a town which moved from United Russia to the communists in the December elections. Now, there, interestingly, it's a much lower class of people, not so many people who've done well out of the system. But interestingly, even the older people, the pensioners there, feel not that they want to turn the clock back, but they feel they don't have the choice about who's going to be president. They like the current president, Dmitry Medvedev. One 78-year-old Valeri told me, he said, you know, I want the chance to vote for him. Why is that being taken away from me? So for various reasons, there is this real rumble of discontent throughout the country.
Well, and let's listen to a gentleman you spoke to in Nizhny. He's a retired engineer. He used to be a Putin supporter, but he voted against Putin's party in the parliamentary elections in December. Let's listen to his reasoning.
It was a protest vote. We wanted to show Putin and his party that they are not the only option, so that they finally listen to the people.
So, as you said, discontent on all sides, people who want a chance to vote for Putin, but people who also, there's some discontent. And I'm just wondering, they want to show him he's not the only option. Is he not the only option? I mean, what's the competition?
He is the only option, frankly, because the competition isn't very great. There is one businessman, a very successful businessman, Mikhail Prokhorov, who was previously loyal to him. He's now standing against him. But apart from that, there really aren't too many alternatives. There's the leader of the Communist Party, Gennady Zyuganov, who has been running for president certainly since 1996, as far as I can remember, perhaps before then. And apart from that, really no one. So there is no one you'll find, I think, in Russia who doubts that Vladimir Putin will become president again. The only slight question mark is over whether he will do it in the first round or not. He needed to get more than 50% of the votes for that to happen. Over the last couple of days, he himself, interestingly, has been holding out the possibility they might have to go to a second round. But even if it does, there's no doubt he would win. That would, though, be something of a slap across the face for him, because he has enjoyed huge, huge levels of popularity. Although, as we saw at the December parliamentary elections, his party has really slipped in the polls. They lost about 15% in those elections. His people, interestingly, have been trying to distance themselves from the party a bit, saying, look, this is not about the party, it's about the man. But that only exacerbates those kind of feelings we heard from the man I spoke to. So it'll be interesting to see how Vladimir Putin deals with it.
The BBC's James Kumarasamy speaking to us from Moscow ahead of what are expected to be huge protests this weekend. James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Next Tuesday, fans of Charles Dickens will celebrate the 200th anniversary of his birth and the characters he created. Oliver Twist, Scrooge, Tiny Tim, characters that brought to life the hardships of the working poor during England's Industrial Revolution. Dickens became so famous that he was greeted like a rock star during his first visit to the U.S. in 1842. On this day, February 3rd, the 29-year-old paid a visit to the famous mills of Lowell, Massachusetts, north of Boston. These were considered model factories where mainly female workers known as the Lowell Mill Girls mobbed Dickens, and he wrote about them.
These girls were all well-dressed, and that phrase necessarily includes extreme cleanliness. They had serviceable bonnets, good warm cloaks, and shawls. They were healthy in appearance, many of them remarkably so, and had the manners and deportment of young women, not of degraded brutes of burden.
The words of Charles Dickens observing an American mill and, of course, comparing it to the deplorable conditions of industrial England. And our next guest says that visit transformed Dickens. Diana Archibald is a Dickens expert. She's the co-curator and lead scholar of an exhibition about Dickens at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She's an associate professor of English there. Diana, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And let's underscore this again, because we know, everyone in New England knows that some of the mill girls, they worked in terribly dangerous situations. Their hair and their fingers and their dresses could get caught in machinery. They were sometimes quite young. But he was comparing it to the things that we heard about in works like Oliver Twist.
Yeah, even worse than that. In fact, in the 1840s, there were, I think, something close to 80,000 people living in Manchester in England in cellar apartments with raw sewage seeping through the walls. So you talk about that sort of living condition, and then you go up to Lowell, where there's these nice boarding houses that were made and fresh young girls coming from the countryside to work for a couple of years in the factories and go home. And of course, we have to remember that Dickens, when he came, was 29 years old, and he liked the girls, and they were educated, they were articulate, they had the Lowell Offering, a wonderful literary magazine, they knew how to play the piano, and the contrast, again, for him with the working population of England was so great.
Sure.
And so that is what really stood out for him.
And maybe he saw something else in them, because some spirit or something, because we know that years after his visit, they would strike against, a proposed cut in wages. These girls work from 5 in the morning till 7 at night for about 73 hours every week, you know. And their strike paved the way for the modern labor movement. So maybe he also saw something else in them.
If he did see that, he would have been pretty displeased, because he wasn't exactly a fan of unions. He felt that there should be other ways of solving these problems, that people in charge of the mills ought to exhibit humanity, and that society ought to exemplify that as well. And so he thought the mill system was great, and I think if he realized how much unrest there already was, that it would have been a different tale.
Isn't that interesting? You know, Charles Dickens, we think of him as the defender of the downtrodden worker, but only to a certain degree.
Well, he was. He just was. You have to remember, too, this is 1842, and it wasn't that long before that where there were riots and revolutions.
Fascinating. And you say he was changed, or at least altered somewhat, by that visit to the Lowell Mills. How so?
Well, he writes when he returns, and he's in the midst of his next novel, Martin Chuzzlewit. He writes to a friend that he'd never felt so strong, that he'd never felt such power in his writing as before that time. And many critics talk about the difference in his writing. There's a sense of confidence. There's also a sense of complexity. It's as if coming abroad gave him a different view of the complexity of social problems, but also a sense of hope that these problems could be solved, and a voraciousness of appetite for going after the hypocrisy, the greed that were underlying social oppression.
He was treated like a rock star when he came here, and he left feeling like, I have to do something with this.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yeah. And to his credit, he always seemed to try to use that power to effect change and to help the lives of those more unfortunate.
Talk a little bit more about his place in history. You know, you can sort of think like, oh, yeah, Dickens, he was part of a line of authors. Well, no, he sort of was the beginning of a line of literary superstars.
He is absolutely the first celebrity in the new age of mass media. He came and the paparazzi were hounding him and the public were following everywhere, plucking bits of his bearskin coat. He was a literary superstar. And, you know, the Sykes and Nancy scene.
Bill Sykes.
Oh, my gosh.
And Oliver Twist.
Dickens wanted to be an actor, in fact. When he was little, his father would put him and his sister on a table in the pub, and they'd do a little song and a dance. And he had a great sense of what would produce an effect in the audience. And when he was composing his novels, in fact, he would stand up and rush to the mirror, practice the face and the voice, and then he would run back to the table and write it out. So he was very much conscious of the theatricality of his works.
Nancy, of course, is the woman who helps shepherd the orphans who work for Bill Sykes, who's the bad guy.
Yeah, Nancy's the prostitute.
She sings As Long As He Needs Me. Oh, wait, that's in the musical.
Yeah, very different.
But he murders her.
Yes, he does. He bludgeons her to death. Yeah. And it's a horrific scene, and Dickens really played it up.
People would faint.
Well, some say those readings killed him. He was only 58 when he died. And he worked himself to death. And his doctor said, you ought not to do any more readings, and you certainly ought not to do Sykes and Nancy.
Wow. We are going to be hearing things you never heard before about Charles Dickens in the next couple of days, because we are coming up on the Dickens Bicentenary. It'll be marked by exhibits, performances of his work, a Twitter book club organized by the Museum of London. And you're a Dickens scholar. You are seeing Dickens get his due.
Yes, absolutely. I think that people think of Dickens as that old guy with a beard that's not relevant, and he is relevant. In fact, I think of him as sort of like John Stewart. He's a satirist. He looks at the hypocrisy, the cruelty, the greed, and he uses his wit as a weapon to effect change.
Diana Archibald, the co-curator and lead scholar of the Bicentenary exhibition on Charles Dickens at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, an associate professor of English at UMass Lowell. We'll have all the information at hereandnow.org and whatever we can get in there about events around the world. Diana, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I have my football-shaped cake all ready. It's Super Bowl 46, Pats Giants, Manning Brady, Beantown Big Apple rematch, a chance for Pats coach Bill Belichick to make history and join Pittsburgh's Chuck Knoll as the only coaches with four Super Bowl titles if the Pats win. David Steele is columnist for SportingNews.com. He joins us from Indianapolis. David, your take on the matchup.
It's going to be, again, a lot like the last time they met in the Super Bowl 4 years ago. Tom Brady and his offense against the Giants and their defense, and the last time around the Giants defense won. Tom Brady's still Tom Brady, but the Giants defense is still the Giants defense, and that's going to be what we're going to watch. And this is not to exclude Eli Manning from all of this, but I think that's going to be the decisive matchup of this game.
Well, and we remember back in 2008, the only game that was ever won when a helmet caught a football. Do you think that that loss for the Patriots when the New Yorks, you know, spoiled their perfect season will give them maybe a little extra oomph, a little, you know, more of a revenge factor?
They're trying to say that it's not, but nobody believes them. One of the things the Patriots do so well is find the motivation that they need. They find the slights that they feel need to be corrected. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have a lot to play for.
Well, the Giants quarterback Eli Manning is said to be on a better roll, and I believe after his last game, Tom Brady did say, I sucked. And so he might agree to that. But what do you think, I mean, when you match up the quarterbacks?
Eli Manning, I think, has proven that 4 years ago was not a fluke. He is the hot quarterback of the two coming into this game. I mean, he's been spectacular and exemplary and nearly perfect and as tough as a quarterback has ever been during a stretch of playoff games. And Brady has not been the Brady that we've been familiar with. That's one of the reasons why, if you're looking for a turning point, you would say that, you know, what the Giants' defense is capable of doing to a quarterback that's not on his best game right now.
Yeah, and we have to ask about the Patriots' Rob Gronkowski, the Gronk. He of the oven mitt hands. They are 11 inches from thumb to pinky span, but of course it's his ankle that's been a problem. Any word on whether he's going to play?
They're leaning very hard toward him playing. He got onto the practice field on Thursday, that was an incredibly positive sign, because the Patriots believed all week that he might not be able to practice. And they're going to sort of cross their fingers and hope for the best that he's going to be able to get through the entire game, because they're a completely different team without him.
In his case, very big fingers. David Steele, columnist for AOLSportingNews.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Of course, we are here in Massachusetts, which used to be New York Giants territory. That's right, the Patriots didn't even come along till 1960. Of course, the ranks of Giants fans have thinned a bit, but there's still a New York Football Giants fan club of New England, and of course, the company that called itself Giant Glass because the team was so popular here.
Who do you call when your windshield busted?
Call Giant Glass.
And then, about halfway between New York and Boston, lies the Connecticut River Valley, where split team loyalties among families, friends, and lovers are legend. Eric Bartholomew lives in Stafford Springs, Connecticut. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And we have Tracy Hicks of Vernon, Connecticut. Tracy, you there?
Yes, ma'am.
We understand you've been dating for about 2 months, and we'll see how long that lasts.
Maybe not a week.
Because, Eric, you are a lifelong fan of the Patriots, and Tracy, diehard New York Giants fan.
Absolutely.
Well, so how's that going?
Oh, I don't even know. Well, actually, all season long, I've been thrown in his face about the 08 Super Bowl, that we won against them, and we'll just win against it now if we make it. So for most of this postseason, I was actually cheering for the Patriots so that we could have number 2 win against them in just a few years.
Not happening.
Okay, so Eric, that 08 Super Bowl, that incredible catch on his helmet by David Tyree.
I mean, catch.
Oh, my gosh. That set up a game-winning touchdown.
It did.
Have you gotten over that yet? I mean, are you afraid of that going into the Super Bowl on Sunday?
I don't know. It should be good. I don't think there's as much pressure, and we're ready to get some redemption for that loss.
Not going to happen.
But seriously, it sounds like you're handling this quite well. It doesn't sound like it ever gets too serious.
Well, we'll see this weekend. We haven't actually matched each other up yet.
That's
so
right.
It's kind of been, he cheers for my team, I cheer for his team, and we've been waiting for this. And now should be interesting this weekend.
There'll be a lot of making fun of each other, but it won't be anything, like, heated.
That's what he thinks.
So, yeah, maybe.
I may get a little angry.
I would stay away from the guacamole, Eric. That's Pats fan Eric Bartholomew and Giants fan Tracy Hicks from Central Connecticut. The Super Bowl borders right down the middle of their town. Eric, Tracy, thanks so much, and best of luck to both.
Thank you.
Well, Eric, Tracy, and maybe the biggest TV audience ever may get to witness a comeback during the halftime show. Madonna will be live at the Super Bowl halftime show, and music critic Tim Riley tells us what to expect.
Madonna's been a very busy material girl lately, petulant, unsympathetic, and impossibly stiff while accepting a Golden Globe.
Hi. This is a surprise.
The award was for Masterpiece, a song Madonna wrote for W.E., her directorial debut, about the romance between England's King Edward VIII and Wallace Simpson, the American divorcee he gave up the throne for. Oh, by the way, the film opens this week.
Your family will never stand for it. The Prime Minister won't stand for it.
Then I'll give up the throne.
And I will be the most despised woman in the world.
Also on the to-do list this week for the 53-year-old with 4 kids, a new CD, MDNA, backed by a reported $3 million deal with Universal. And, oh yeah, then there's the Super Bowl. As a world conqueror of pop entering her fourth decade, Madonna's shtick has grown tiresome for some. Apparently not for the NBC execs who booked her for the halftime show. With an estimated audience of 160 million plus, that's mad, mad, mad exposure. And you could imagine Madonna's younger rivals, Lady Gaga, Rihanna, even yesterday's girl, Britney Spears, taking that stage to make a thoroughly contemporary statement. So what will Madonna do? For starters, she'll be hawking the new single off her forthcoming album with guest rapper Nicki Minaj in an elaborate Cirque du Soleil production number.
Don't play the stupid game, 'cause I'm a different kind of girl. Every record sounds the same, you gotta step into my world. Give me all your love and give me your love.
As pop's biggest, longest-running performer, Madonna resembles Elvis Presley in how she mirrors the best and worst in her culture. Take that interview with ABC's Cynthia McFadden. When asked, Madonna allowed that Lady Gaga's Born This Way sounded strangely familiar to her 1989 hit, Express Yourself. Listen for yourself.
There's nothing wrong with loving who you are, she said, 'cause he made you perfect, babe.
Anybody can tell that Gaga has learned from Madonna in both eyeliner and outrage. Gaga herself has acknowledged the influence. But when pressed, the diva put the screws to the upstart, calling Born This Way
reductive.
Is that good?
Look it up.
Reductive. Definition? Simplified. Crude. Yow! With that kind of bravado, Madonna will face a peculiar challenge at the Super Bowl, taking the reins of her stage act without worrying about Hollywood. She's rumored to have old favorites Vogue and Holiday on her set list, and with the right touch, she could just upstage her own puzzle of a persona. Much like Elvis in his 1968 Christmas special, the Material Girl maintains enough charisma to make everybody else seem like a footnote to her royal curls. For Madonna, Super Bowl hype beckons like career destiny.
And I can't tell you why it hurts so much to be in love with a masterpiece.
Tim Riley, author of Madonna Illustrated and a new biography of John Lennon. For more, you can go to herenow.org. And by the way, did you see Madonna do the Victor Cruz salsa the other day? He's the player who's with the Giants now, but he played for the UMass Minutemen. So look for him to do the salsa in the end zone, but not too much. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
It can't be fun to always be the chosen one, and I'm right by your side, like a thief in the night. I stand in front of a masterpiece.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.